Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing. And on this edition, a growing trade war between China and the European Union. China is now putting tariffs on brandy imports. We hear from the boss of Uber on the advantages of cheap Chinese electric cars. Chile sees a welcome drop in inflation and a house for a dollar. An experiment in the US to revive neighbourhoods and help people get on the housing ladder. And you can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. The number is +44 330 678 3033. But let's start with China. The slow-motion trade war between China and the European Union has just stepped up a notch. China's announced new tariffs on brandy imports from the EU. It claims the EU is dumping brandy in China, and its domestic industry is threatened with substantial damage as a result. The level of the tariffs wasn't specified, but China's Commerce Ministry said that from Friday, importers would have to pay a security deposit to bring brandy from the EU into China. 99% of China's brandy imports come from France at a value of approximately $1.7 billion, and France is regarded as the target of these tariffs. Now, it all comes as the EU is pushing ahead with its own plans for tariffs on electric vehicles imported from China. Well, let's dissect all this with Dr. Yu Jie, who's a senior research fellow on China at the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House. Dr. Yu Jie, thanks for being with us. So why do you think China has done this at this point?
Well, thank you for having me. I think part of the reason for this is that China looking to who are the main proponents for this tariff on electric vehicles. Obviously, France is really at forefront on this. So I think it's in a way, it's a messaging of tit for tat retaliation from Beijing. And also, I think Chinese picked the sector quite carefully on brandy because it's not really a massive consumer products, which does not really affect the Chinese everyday consumers to use this at all. But however, brandy, it is a quite important export sector for France.
So yeah, and clearly it's very symbolic, isn't it? It's a way of sending a message. But it's an interesting situation because at the moment there aren't actually tariffs, or the tariff program hasn't gone into effect on Chinese electric cars coming into the EU. It's potential, but it hasn't actually happened.
Well, I think it's really playing a poker in here, basically, to showing the signaling that how much damage that Beijing can do in terms of retaliation. But I think Beijing also looking quite carefully not to retaliate every single country that has either voted for this motion and also abstaining this motion.
So in a way, as you say, they're playing quite a careful game. But the Chinese in the end, will they, if these tariffs do come in on electric vehicles, if that's confirmed, will there be more areas in which China will impose tariffs? What sort of areas?
Well, I think mostly will be agriculture areas. Again, China looking into this very carefully on which country has voted for this motion and agreed to imposing a tariff on EVs and hence pick those sectors that has a large quantity of imports towards China, export towards China, but also the Chinese will buy quite a lot from them. So try to choose strategically on which sector that would impact on each individual member states the most. I think that's the reasoning behind.
It's beginning to become a kind of trade war, in effect, and that's pretty clear. And normally, the idea is that these kind of things are settled through the World Trade Organization, the WTO, and I know that the EU is moving in that area. Is that going to be an area where this could be settled, do you think?
Well, it's very hard for the moment. I think neither side want to back down. Europeans want to protect their own industry, and then EVs has been one of the emerging valuable export for the Chinese, and that's really determining on the China's economic model, how it runs these days. So I think even if they're going through the WTO mechanism, it will take quite a long time, but I doubt either side will back down on this.
So they might in the end just say, well, look, we'll go into a trade war, but that's going to be hugely damaging to both sides, isn't it?
It is hugely damaging both sides, but I think the caveat in here, it is also, I think both sides, both Beijing and Brussels, observe very carefully and who will become the next U.S. president. If we have the Trump return, then the most likely case of a potential trade war between Beijing and Brussels may be called off more easily, because then even much bigger animal that Beijing will have to deal with, or Europeans will have to deal with, is Donald Trump.
Because in the past, Donald Trump certainly pushed quite hard against China. So in those circumstances, I mean, in a way, it's a three-way problem. But the EU is not likely, as you said, to back down. In the end, is this something that China really thinks it can win?
Well, not necessarily China can win or not win, but I think Beijing just want to choose the moment quite carefully and sending a warning now to Brussels to see what, you know, whether there might be a leeway or room for further negotiation. I think I've noticed on the statement offered by MOFCOM today, the Ministry of Commerce, saying the two sides will continue to do the talk, but how long this process will go and how substantive this talk will go, I think let's wait and see.
Do you think there is wiggle room? Do you think there is room for compromise at all?
Well, I think, again, China were taking the tactics individually by taking individual member states. China's preferences in the past has always been more willing to talk bilaterally rather than through the European Commission. I know it's under the EU Trade Commission competency, but China's tactic has always been talking to each individual member state and let member states influence Brussels.
Divide and conquer, I guess. Dr. Yu Ji, thanks so much for being with us on that. So how does all this look from Brussels? Well, I spoke earlier to Olaf Gill, European Commission spokesperson for trade and agriculture.
So our response is very clear on this. We have noted it, and we will challenge at the World Trade Organization this imposition of measures by China on imports of brandy from the European Union. We will do so because we believe that these measures are completely unfounded, and we are determined to defend European industry against what we view as the abuse of trade defense instruments by China.
They say that you're dumping brandy in China and their own domestic industries threaten with substantial damage.
We're very confident that the facts will prove that to not be the case at all. If anything, the facts indicate an entirely different picture. My understanding is that European cognac exports, brandy exports, target the kind of the top segment of consumption in China. There are indigenous Chinese brandy producers, but they're in a different market segment. And so there really isn't an issue here. And therefore, we will be strongly contesting it, as I said, on the basis of facts.
But we all know why this is happening. It's to do with your own proposed tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles coming into the EU.
All I can say on that is that the proposal by the European Commission to launch an investigation, first of all, into imports of Chinese electric vehicles and the risk of injury to European industry from aforementioned subsidies is entirely fact-based, based on a body of painstakingly gathered evidence, hundreds of man and woman hours spent inspecting Chinese facilities, and detailed engagement with a number of Chinese electric vehicle producers. And therefore, the European Union does not want to impose tariffs for the sake of imposing tariffs. We've been consistently clear on that. All we want is fairness. All we want is a level playing field where our electric vehicles can compete fairly with Chinese electric vehicles. We're happy for Chinese electric vehicles to come into the European Union. We want our consumers to have choice, but it must be based on fairness.
Okay, well, but both sides are always going to say these kind of things. The fact is, you're moving into a slow-motion trade war. That's what's going to happen.
I can only repeat what I just said, that we believe the facts are on our side and we believe that the evidence is on our side.
But the impact on Europe is not going to be that good, is it? I mean, if for example, France, 99% of China's brandy imports came from France last year. The French are going to suffer as a result of this. It doesn't seem like either side is going to give ground, so the war will continue to both sides' detriment.
Well, all I can say to that is that the vehicle sector and increasingly the electric vehicle sector is an industry of strategic
huge strategic importance for the European Union. I think something like 9 million people are related in direct and indirect jobs in the auto industry. So, of course, we're going to take every step to protect that important sector and those important jobs when the evidence shows that those jobs are potentially threatened by unfair subsidies and unfair competition. We will take steps to defend our industry, nothing more, nothing less.
And do you think that the WTO will offer both sides a way out of this?
I can't comment on what
the WTO may or may not offer, but we can say with total confidence from the EU side that we're happy to engage with China in the appropriate WTO structures on our own case and any cases of theirs. Because, as I have said already, we are entirely confident that the facts and the evidence are on our side.
Olaf Gill there of the European Commission. So let's talk about what's been going on the share markets today. Fiona Cincotta, Senior Market Analyst at City Index, joins me now. Fiona, thanks for being with us again. Well, I mean, the real action, I guess, was mostly in Asia because Chinese markets were up and running again, of course, after Golden Week. And there was a response to, well, the various changes that have been the way that China is running its economy, but the markets weren't that impressed.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we did see a rather big reaction, particularly in the Hang Seng, actually. The Hang Seng plunged about 9.5%. And basically what we're seeing here, what we were seeing was a bit of disappointment, actually, as sort of traders came back to their desks after the week-long holiday. And that disappointment was because there wasn't further stimulus being announced from China, and there weren't further details on the stimulus that had already been announced. So it's almost as if skepticism was sort of starting to seep into the market. And that really was reflected strongly in the Hang Seng. We've also seen it hit, for example, the miners and resource stocks on the FTSE, and oil has also dropped sharply.
Well, I was going to ask you about oil, because, of course, that is dependent on some fairly dramatic politics that's been happening in the Middle East, and conflict, of course. But yet, oil prices dropping. Why?
Yeah, so I mean, oil's down around 4.5%, so a huge drop in oil prices. So just think, last week we saw a massive rise in oil. It was up around 9%, strongest weekly gain since around March 2023. And that was because of expectations and concerns that oil supply could be disrupted if there was a broadening out of the conflict in the Middle East. Now, I think it's fair to say that the dust has definitely not settled as far as the Middle East is concerned, but because there hasn't been a direct attack on oil infrastructure in Iran, the market's just shifted its gaze away from the Middle East and towards China. Again, this lack of stimulus news from China. China's the largest importer of oil. There are just a few concerns surrounding economic growth in China again, and that's sending oil prices back down.
Okay, well, let's take a look at the US trade deficit, because that's really interesting. It's narrowed sharply in August, according to the latest figures. Exports increasing to a record high. I mean, bit of a surprise.
Yes. And I mean, you know, this is an encouraging surprise as well. If we think about sort of what's going on in the US economy, we've now seen this strong export data. We saw strong jobs data on Friday. We've also seen sort of consumer spending is holding up. So I think the message here is that the US economy is actually on a relatively solid footing. Now, as you said, exports reached a record high. We saw capital goods. Also, exports of services were really high. So this is going to be some encouraging news for the US as it goes towards this period of uncertainty ahead of the US elections.
Yes, it could all be very, very interesting, couldn't it? And we'll watch the markets with you, I'm sure, Fiona. Fiona, thanks for being with us. Fiona Cincotta there, Senior Market Analyst at City Index. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, cheap Chinese electric vehicles. Well, we heard how the EU isn't keen on them. But according to the boss of Uber, the drive-sharing app, they're actually good for the planet. He's Dara Khosrowshahi, and he's been speaking to our business editor, Simon Jack.
I think cheap Chinese vehicles are a good thing for the environment. And I would tell you that China is transitioning from not just being cheap, but also being high quality as well. And for us, we want to electrify our fleet, and we want to make sure that it is affordable for our drivers to switch over to EVs. Now, the political considerations of tariffs, et cetera, are not something that we can comment on, et cetera, but our focus is on the environment, and we think Chinese vehicles that are low cost, that are high quality, could be a very important part of the switch over to EVs.
Do you have a view on tariffs? Good thing, bad thing?
I don't have a view on tariffs.
Okay, but they make these cheap cars and these high-quality cars more expensive in some of your key markets. By what you've said so far, it would follow. You think that's a bad thing?
I think if I'm taking a pure climate view, it would be a negative, just being honest.
Are we just at a moment of revolution and disruption? And that in all of these cases, where you have disruption, you have some people, some legacy players who don't make it. And are we at that moment right now?
Listen, that's a definition of disruption, right? Every revolution, changeover in platform usually starts with a huge amount of momentum, and then you've got to keep pushing. It'll go through a period of difficulty, which I do think we are in EVs, and you've got to keep pushing through. And the fact is that change can affect some players negatively, but this is a change in the name of climate and emissions, and I believe we have to keep pushing forward.
What do you say to the consumer, the Uber consumer? You're saying that you should be able to have a preference for an EV vehicle. Are you telling consumers, just be a bit more patient and wait for an EV?
What we're setting, actually, a new product that we are offering for riders is for them to set an EV preference. But we will only dispatch an EV if the difference between the dispatch is only a couple of minutes. So we're not saying, hey, wait 15 minutes. But if you have to wait another 2-3 minutes to help the environment, why not make that investment in terms of your own time?
So be more patient to help the environment.
A couple of minutes isn't going to kill anyone.
Do you not think that there is a danger that we're becoming more sedentary and lazier as a result of things like Uber?
I think that technology generally, screens, et cetera, do come at a societal cost, right? And you and
including
I are sitting
Uber.
Here having... Listen, Uber is part of it, although Uber, within the scope of thing, the time that people spend on Uber is actually pretty low. But I think it's ultimately up to the individual, right, to balance out their lives, to make sure that they have real-life interactions.
The views of Dara Khosrowshahi, the boss of Uber. You can tell us what you think on all that if you want to, because we've got a new way of you communicating with us. It's WhatsApp, and the number, +44 330 678 3033. But let's talk about Chile now, because we've talked a lot about inflation in the US and Europe, but the problem has been very damaging to the economies of many low- and middle-income countries around the world. The latest drop in consumer prices in Chile, which has just been announced, is welcome news, of course, for hard-pressed shoppers there. Prices in the world's largest copper producer were up 0.1% in September from the previous month, below the 0.3% expected by economists, and annual inflation hit 4.1%, which is down from the 4.7% reported in the previous month. Expectations are growing that the central bank there is going to cut interest rates when it meets next week. Let's speak to Patricia Navia, who's professor of political science at the Diego Portales University in Chile. He's actually in New York right now. So, Patricia, welcome to the program. First of all, were you surprised that inflation is coming down as much as it is in Chile?
Well, yes and no. Yes, because prices were moving up rather quickly, worryingly. Remember that in Chile, most things are indexed to inflation, including mortgages. So every time there is inflation, families have to pay more for their mortgage every month. So the mortgage price goes up, and that makes life more difficult for people. But I wasn't that surprised because the economy has been slowing down a bit. And normally when the economy slows down, then inflation always goes down because people have less money to spend. So it was expected. But as you mentioned, the expectation for this month's inflation was 0.4%, but it came down at 0.1%, which is very, very good news for people because they are going to have to spend less money in buying the things that they normally do.
Yeah, it is interesting also what you were saying about how the economy is slowing down. I mean, that can be a bad thing as well, of course. But it's interesting also to reflect on how that's going to affect decisions on interest rates. I mean, there's been speculation that it could go down by 25 basis points to 5.25. It's still pretty high.
Yes, it's still pretty high, and that's one of the reasons why the economy is not picking up, right? Because borrowing money is still very costly, so The central bank has to lower interest rates, but for them to do so, they needed to have better news on inflation. So this news will probably suggest to the central bank that it is time to start speeding up the slowing down of interest rates and then jump-starting the economy as a result. So probably the central bank will move more aggressively in the next months to lower interest rates because they are no longer quite as concerned about inflation picking up.
Yeah, it's still not the target, though, 3%, is it?
Well, no, we still have some way to go there. There are elections next year in Chile, so the outgoing government is particularly concerned with trying to pressure the central bank to reduce interest rates. The central bank, of course, is not up for election, so they are concerned with keeping inflation down. But this good news will probably make them think that lowering interest rates a bit faster is not going to negatively affect inflation.
So, Patricia, let's talk about the engine that's driving the Chilean economy, which is, of course, copper. It's the biggest copper producer in the world. I mean, it is very dependent on what is a very volatile commodity that can cause big problems for the country's economy, I guess.
Absolutely. 80% of Chile's exports are associated to copper. So copper is what why Chile matters to the rest of the world. When copper prices go up, the dollar depreciates in Chile, and that means that imports are cheaper for Chileans to buy, but other exports become a bit more expensive. So copper has a dual effect on the Chilean economy. We have to pay attention to copper, but as long as there is still demand for copper, even though there are fluctuations, governments can take measures, including creating sovereign wealth funds, to save money when copper prices are high and spend money when copper prices are low, which is what Chile did about 20 years ago. And that helps diminish the negative impact of copper fluctuations.
See if that works, I guess. Patricia, thanks so much. Patricia Navia there. Now, a shortage of affordable homes has become a major issue around the world. A UN report earlier this year suggested 1.6 billion people worldwide lack adequate housing, and that could rise to 3 billion by 2030. Some areas are attempting to find local solutions. In parts of the US, vacant properties have been sold off for just $1, allowing people to get on the housing ladder who might not otherwise be able to afford it, while attempting to regenerate those places. Well, the BBC's Rowan Bridge has been to the city of Baltimore to find out if its $1 home scheme is the key to invigorating a place.
You must be Judy.
You must be Rowan.
Yes, nice. Judy Alex Sauser's red brick house is part of an immaculately kept street in the Pigtown area of Baltimore. But it wasn't like this when she first purchased it. When she and her neighbours bought their homes, they were in a state of decay and needed significant renovation.
They were old and run down, and everybody had to gut the houses and fill the shells in, each one of us with an individual plan. The fact that I went through one contractor who gutted the house, tore out the roof, and then he left, and for 3 months, it rained 29 days out of every month. I had to get a new contractor, then it froze. And so for October, November, December, the house was wet and frozen. So it was a horror story. I came very close to declaring personal bankruptcy. It's kind of like childbirth, you know. It was horrible while it was going on. But, you know, after it was all over, it said, it's mine. It's all mine.
What made Judy's house purchase unusual was how much she paid, $1. To understand why a city would sell off a home for a dollar, you need to understand some of the history of Baltimore. David Simon's the creator of the TV series The Wire. It chronicled the gritty side of the city over 5 seasons. And he says from the 1950s, Baltimore was hit by the loss of industry and so-called white flight, the movement of white families from the city to the suburbs. Both caused the population to decline and Baltimore's housing to decay.
Baltimore itself went from about 950,000, a million people in 1950 down to maybe just under 600,000 today. There were a lot of vacant row houses, many of them dating to the 1800s.
dollar houses. I got a couple things for you to...
At the time, Jay Brody was a senior figure in the Baltimore City Council housing department. He'd heard how Wilmington and Delaware had sold off homes for a dollar and thought they could do something similar with around 40 houses they had vacant on Sterling Street in the city.
We said, wait a minute, this might be the ideal concentration to test this dollar house thing. And so we advertised the 40 houses. We were overwhelmed.
How much of a difference did it make to those neighborhoods?
It was significant. It was visible. We're not talking about plans on paper. We're talking about something that you can see and touch.
Baltimore City Council has approved a measure that would allow some of those vacant properties in Baltimore City to be sold for just
$1. Now the city is again selling off some of its empty properties for a dollar. It's part of something known as the fixed price program. Baltimore's housing commissioner, Alice Kennedy, is keen to stress this isn't your parents' $1 house scheme.
The intent was to make it very streamlined and understandable for anybody that was going to purchase a property from us, that you knew exactly what you would have to pay for that property.
The benefits may be clear. An area becomes more prosperous and livable. But who loses out?
My name is David Lids. I'm the CEO of Water Bottle Cooperative. As a cooperative, we buy and renovate severely distressed homes in severely distressed Baltimore neighborhoods. And then we use that work to hire folks.
Water Bottle's operations pretty small scale. Under their model, the homes are owned by the workers who do the work, and they're also the tenants who move into the finished properties. David Lids says he has reason to be skeptical of the new dollar house scheme.
It's always done at the expense of the poor. So when a neighborhood like Federal Hill gentrifies, there used to be middle class, lower middle class, blue collar, who were there for a long time, and they get pushed out. Rents get jacked up, or landlords just kick them out to sell out. That's not good. We feel like we have the opportunity to rebuild a neighborhood, create this hyper-local, vitalized economy, and keep everybody in it.
The scheme, though, you have to live in that property for 5 years. I mean, presumably that is an attempt to prevent the sort of problem that you're talking about.
Gentrification takes 10 or 15 years. They could stay there 5 years, cash out, and, you know, what have we really accomplished?
Alice Kennedy says she's acutely aware of the pitfalls and mistakes that have been made in the past, and she says she's keen to not see them be repeated. But what all of these schemes have found is that regeneration is hard. Selling off properties cheaply may be successful in some ways, but it's far from a magic bullet for solving a city's housing problems.
Rowan Bridge reporting from Baltimore. And you can hear more from him on BBC Business Daily, but you can join in the conversation too on our new WhatsApp number, +44 330 678 3033, and tell us what you think. But that's pretty much it from World Business Report, from me and the rest of the team. Thanks for being with us. And bye-bye.
Es ist kein Geheimnis, dass geistige und körperliche Gesundheit Hand in Hand gehen. Wir alle streben nach einer guten Work-Life-Balance. Und der Zugang zu den besten Fitness- und Wellness-Einrichtungen, Sportarten und Geräten ist die ultimative Motivation. Als einer der führenden Anbieter von Firmenfitness in Deutschland weiß Hansefit um die Vorteile für Arbeitgeber und Arbeitnehmer. Mit über 8.500 Partnern, die über 50 verschiedene Sportarten anbieten, von Fitness- und Yogastudio, Schwimmbädern und Boulderhallen bis hin zu Wellness-Tempeln, bietet Hansefit jedem etwas. Für mehr Informationen besuche hansefit.de und empfiehl im Mitgliederbereich deinen Arbeitgeber.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
Most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.